What are you most afraid of? I mean, that one thing you wish you could just switch off. It's a tough question, right? But imagine if your biggest fear, well, it sort of showed up as this invisible wall that just stole your voice when you needed it most,
yeah.
even when you really, really wanted to speak. For a lot of kids, that's not hypothetical. It's their reality. It's called selective mutism. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into this often misunderstood condition, sometimes called SM. We've got some great sources lined up, insights from educator Judy Ann Denton Green, research from the Selective Mutism Association, the Child Mind Institute, and Dr. Stephen Kurtz's work, too.
Yeah, and our goal today is, well, it's really to unpack what selective mutism actually is. We want to clear away some of the confusion, the myths that float around, and most importantly, give you some real practical strategies, things you can actually do to help build comfort and communication for kids experiencing this. We want to equip you, you know, with the understanding to really support them effectively.
Okay, so let's dive in. Understanding what it is. Like I said, mutism, that word sounds like. Complete silence, right? But the sources are really clear. Selective mutism is, well, it's more complicated than just not talking.
It absolutely is. And what's really key here, what you need to grasp, is that selective mutism is formally defined as a childhood anxiety disorder. It's basically an inability to speak in specific social settings. Think school, maybe birthday parties, talking to unfamiliar adults. But, and this is crucial, that same child might be totally chatty, even loud, in places they feel safe. Usually that's at home, with their immediate family.
Okay, so anxiety is the driver.
Exactly. And here's the thing that gets misunderstood all the time. It is not a child choosing to be silent. It's not defiance. It's not them being stubborn. It's a genuine anxiety response, almost like a speech freeze. Their brain's sort of alarm system kicks in and overrides their ability to talk, even if they desperately want to.
Wow. Like the words are just locked up.
Pretty much. Imagine, you know, your fight or flight response gets triggered by, say, being called on in class, and it just shuts down the speaking part. It's way beyond just being shy. It's this, like, powerful internal block that stops the words coming out, even if their head is full of things they want to say.
That's a really powerful way to think about it. Not a choice, but this response. Can you maybe paint a picture of what that invisible barrier actually feels like for a child, based on the research? Like, what might we be missing if we just see a quiet kid?
Yeah, definitely. The research suggests it's not just feeling a bit nervous. For a child with SM, the anxiety in those specific situations, it's so intense it physically stops them from speaking. Imagine trying to talk, but your throat feels tight, your heart's pounding, maybe you feel frozen. It's like that, a physical thing. Often the child really wants to speak. They might even have the sentence formed in their head, but it just won't come out. And you might see other signs of anxiety, too. Maybe they freeze up completely, get really stiff, avoid eye contact, or just have a kind of blank look. And our sources point out these kids are usually very aware they're having trouble speaking. They often feel really frustrated, maybe even ashamed about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it gets tougher as they get older, you know? School demands more talking, peer relationships get more important, so the emotional toll is huge. They're battling the silence and how others see them, plus their own desire to connect.
Understanding that internal struggle, that anxiety barrier, it really brings us to the next big challenge, doesn't it? Which is all the misconceptions around selective mutism. If the child feels trapped by anxiety, well, it seems like good support can get trapped too by these myths that just won't go away. Our sources really call these out, and it feels important to tackle them directly because these ideas, even if well-meaning, can end up isolating kids even more.
Exactly right. And a lot of these myths, fundamentally, they come from just not quite getting anxiety, especially how it looks in kids. Let's bust a few of the big ones our sources highlight. Okay, so myth number one, selective mutism is super rare. Well, it's not as common as something like generalized anxiety, sure, but it affects roughly 1 in 140 kids. That's actually more common than autism spectrum disorder, so it's definitely out there. Knowing that helps us see it's not some incredibly unusual thing. Lots of kids might be dealing with this quietly.
1 in 140.
Yeah.
Okay. Not that rare then.
Not really. Then there's the second myth, and this one is really persistent. It's just bad shyness, and they'll grow out of it eventually. This is, well, it's a harmful oversimplification. Shyness is more of a personality trait, right? SM is a clinical anxiety disorder. A shy child might take time to warm up, but they usually can speak eventually. A child with SM has this involuntary block.
So waiting for them to outgrow it isn't the answer.
Definitely not. That wait-and-see approach often means kids don't get help when they need it. And the research is pretty clear. Without support, SM often doesn't just go away. It can stick around into adulthood, impacting everything, school, friendships, even careers.
Okay, what else?
Well, then there's the idea that the child is just being stubborn or maybe manipulative, using silence to control things. Honestly, this couldn't be further from the truth. If they could speak in that moment, believe me, they would. Their silence isn't defiance. It's a symptom of that overwhelming anxiety. It's a freeze response. Calling them stubborn just adds layers of shame and fear.
Right, blaming them for an anxiety symptom.
Precisely, which leads right into the next one. Assuming they are choosing not to speak. Again, it misunderstands how anxiety works. The anxiety physically prevents speech. It's not a conscious decision, not some game they're playing. They're often just upset about not being able to talk as the adults are.
That makes sense.
Another one you hear sometimes is that the child must have experienced some kind of trauma, and that's why they stopped talking. Now, trauma can impact mental health, absolutely, and sometimes it might be a factor in anxiety. But for most kids with SM, it's not the primary cause. SM is more often understood as an anxiety disorder linked to genetics and temperament. Some kids are just kind of biologically predisposed to it, so jumping to conclusions about trauma isn't usually helpful or accurate.
Okay, that's important to clarify.
And finally, there's this myth that SM is incredibly difficult to treat, maybe even untreatable. Look, it definitely takes time. It takes patience. Consistency is key. But effective strategies absolutely exist. The outlook is actually very good with the right kind of support applied consistently, which, you know, leads us nicely into what we can do. It's a lot to unlearn, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But seeing these myths for what they are, step one to providing real help.
It really does clarify things. So let's get practical. For those of us who want to help parents, teachers, maybe just friends, what do we do? If it's anxiety, not a choice, how do we actually support these kids and, you know, gently help them find ways to communicate? Mm-hmm. This is where those evidence-based strategies come in, right? Focusing on comfort first.
Exactly. Comfort first, the very first step. And it's so important because it dials down the pressure immediately, is to build that comfort by accepting nonverbal communication. Just completely allow them to communicate however they can without words. Pointing, nodding, shaking their head, thumbs up, maybe writing things down, drawing, even sending audio or video messages later.
So letting go of the expectation for speech initially.
Totally. And think about practical ways this plays out. A child who finds speaking terrifying can still say, be the bulletin board helper.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can hand out papers, hold the door. These nonverbal jobs give them a way to participate, feel included, feel successful without that huge pressure to talk. It slowly builds their confidence in that space. These little things can be huge.
That really shifts the focus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Away from demanding speech and towards just meeting the child where they are.
Right.
Creating that safe space for them to just be and interact nonverbally at first. Mm-hmm. And our sources also really stress avoiding direct questions, especially early on.
Yes, definitely.
Instead of, like, how was your weekend?
Yeah.
Which can feel like putting them on the spot. Try just a warm greeting that doesn't need a verbal reply. Something simple, like, hey, it's great to see you this morning. We're going to have fun with science today. It lowers the pressure right away. It says your presence here is enough. It's valued.
Absolutely. And building right on that, Judy Ann Denton Green's work gives us this really smart step-by-step approach for gradually building communication. Sometimes it's called fading in. Basically, you move systematically from the least demanding communication to more demanding, always watching the child's anxiety level. So step one is what she calls one-sided communication. You just talk to them, describing what they're doing positively without expecting any verbal reply like, oh, I see you're lining up those blocks so carefully, you're really concentrating, or you picked the green paint, that's a lovely color.
Yeah.
You're acknowledging them, validating them, making them feel seen, but there's zero pressure to respond verbally. It's like saying, I see you, you're okay here.
Okay, so just gentle narration almost.
Kind of, yeah. Once they seem comfortable with that, you can slowly move towards forced choice questions. These are simple questions with just two, maybe three, concrete options. This makes a verbal answer much less daunting. Instead of a wide open, what do you want to do? You could ask, do you want the red crayon or the blue crayon? Or should we read this book or that book? It gives them a very clear, easy path to maybe say just one word.
It makes it much more manageable.
Right. And then another really cool strategy is using video recording. This is clever because it uses their comfort zone. You might encourage them to record themselves at home talking about something they love, their pet, a game, a favorite toy. Then maybe at school, you watch that video together, maybe just with a teacher or a trusted adult first. You're not asking them to talk in the stressful place.
You're discussing something they already talked about where they felt safe.
Exactly. It uses the comfort of home as a sort of bridge to communication at school. It just lowers that barrier quite a bit, meeting them where they are comfortable and then slowly stretching that circle.
I really like that video idea. It feels very respectful of their comfort zone, letting them bring their voice in just differently at first. And beyond those one-on-one things, the whole classroom environment, the school vibe, that matters hugely too, right?
Absolutely.
Our sources mentioned a couple of things here, like pairing the child with a communication buddy, maybe a peer they already know and feel okay with.
Yes, that can be really effective. That low-pressure interaction with a trusted friend. Sometimes kids feel safer trying things out with a peer than an adult.
And small group work too, instead of always whole class stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Breaking down those big group situations into smaller, more predictable interactions can lower anxiety significantly. Ultimately, it's about creating this really inclusive feel where everyone's staff, other kids, understands that learning looks different for different people. And, you know, communicating looks different too. That helps normalize it for the child with SM, makes them feel less singled out. And thinking about schoolwork, the academic side, we obviously need alternatives to just like oral reports. That's just not fair or helpful. So allowing written answers, drawings, maybe building a model, doing a project, even submitting a video presentation they made at home.
Right. Different ways to show what they know.
Exactly. And always, always give plenty of time for them to process and respond if you do ask something verbally, even if it's just a tiny whisper or a nod. Don't rush them. Patience is everything. And when they do communicate, verbally or non-verbally, make sure your praise is specific and genuine, like, thanks for pointing to the book you want, or great job telling me yes. Reinforce the effort without making a huge deal out of it.
Okay. And avoid pressure or guilt, obviously.
Absolutely. That just ramps up the anxiety. What works is consistency, warmth, even if your interactions are one-sided for a while and trying to weave their interests into activities. That builds trust, builds comfort. Oh, and interestingly, some research, like from SMA and Dr. Shippon Blum, suggests avoiding too much direct eye contact initially. It can feel intense. And maybe the biggest do, if the child does speak, even a word, try really hard not to act surprised. Just respond calmly, positively, like it's the most normal thing ever.
That's a great tip. Don't make them feel like they just performed a miracle. Just accept it.
Exactly.
Okay, this all sounds like it really needs teamwork, a consistent approach. Which brings us to families, right? How critical is it to loop families in and work together?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. That question of consistency is key. How do we make sure the child is getting similar messages and support both at home and at school? Our sources really stress regular open communication, teachers and parents sharing what strategies are working, what the child enjoys, what feels challenging. Families have such valuable insights, you know. They know what comforts their child, their interests, how they communicate when they are comfortable. When everyone, parents, teachers, maybe a therapist, if one is involved, is on the same page, using similar approaches, reinforcing the same things, that creates a really predictable, safe feeling for the child. That consistency is what helps them make progress faster.
And celebrating the wins together, however small.
Absolutely. Celebrating those small steps together. Maybe they whispered hi to the teacher. Maybe they pointed to what they wanted at lunch. That shared celebration builds momentum and reinforces everyone's efforts. It really has to be a unified front.
That makes total sense. A fragmented approach just wouldn't work. Okay, so on the flip side then, what about the don'ts? Are there clear things we should absolutely avoid doing? Actions that could actually make things worse. Our sources mentioned some red flags.
Yes, definitely. Knowing what not to do is just as crucial. One of the biggest no-nos is calling attention to their silence, especially in front of other kids or adults. Can you imagine how embarrassing that would be? It just deepens their self-consciousness, ramps up the pressure, the exact opposite of what we want.
Publicly highlighting their difficulty.
Exactly. And absolutely avoid forcing speech, saying things like, you can't leave until you say goodbye, or punishing them for not talking. That kind of pressure only increases anxiety and can create really negative feelings about speaking altogether. Another really important don't is speaking for them or constantly trying to guess what they mean from gestures.
Even if you're trying to be helpful.
Even then. While it might seem kind in the moment, it can actually take away their power, their opportunity to try communicating themselves, even non-verbally. It doesn't encourage them to take those small steps. All these things, pressure, punishment, speaking for them, they really undermine trust and work against building those independent communication skills.
Okay, that's really clear. So we've covered a lot today. We've gone from really defining selective mutism more clearly, understanding it's rooted in anxiety, not choice, to busting some common unhelpful myths and then digging into these really practical, compassionate strategies for how to actually build comfort and support communication. It seems like the absolute foundation is recognizing SM as a genuine anxiety disorder. That shift in understanding changes everything, doesn't it?
It really does. And if you think about the bigger picture here, exploring SM really shines a light on just how profoundly anxiety can impact a child's whole way of interacting with the world. But it also shows how much difference tailored, patient, consistent support can make. It gives hope. And maybe that leaves you with something to think about. How might really understanding anxiety in kids using some of the ideas we talked about today change how we react not just to selective mutism, but maybe to a whole range of challenges or unique needs we see in the children around us?
Right.
How can we foster more supportive, more empathetic environments overall?
That's a great question to reflect on. We really hope this deep dive has given you some valuable insights and maybe some practical tools you can use. Thanks so much for joining us today.